This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico. More than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
How many Fed speeches is too many Fed speeches? Not a rhetorical question, by the way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 16th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There will be this week a veritable cornucopia of monetary policy tea leaves to be read. They will come, those tea leaves will, courtesy of no less than 14, count them, 14 speeches by officials of the Federal Reserve, members of the Board of Governors in Washington, that is, as well as a handful of presidents of regional banks today through Friday. And without having heard them, one can hazard a guess as to the general vibe. Rates are going to stay high for a while. They're going to wait and see what the data says. The economy is generally strong. Lather, rinse, repeat. But the fact of the matter is that the central bank having raised rates so fast and so relatively high, people and parts of this economy are being left to deal with the fallout, to wit, real estate. The average 30-year fixed rate mortgage right now is near 7.6%. That's the latest from Freddie Mac. So we have gotten our mortgage rate expert on the phone. Vivian Geller is Chief Financial Officer at Pacific Trust Group. That's a mortgage lender here in Los Angeles. Vivian, it's good to have you on again.
Thank you, Kai. Nice to be here again.
So look, what does a mortgage lender do when mortgage rates are doing what they do right now?
Oh, gosh. I probably should have taken up golf, but I think a lot of people in real estate, not just mortgage lenders, but a lot of people in real estate have like side hustles. So in my case, you know, I do flip houses. So I've been concentrating on that a little more because it's just been dead quiet for the last, I'd say, 4 months, really.
So what are you going to, well, so let's talk about your business first. What are you going to do? Do you just wait it out?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a choice. You know, there's just really not a whole lot going on. We're doing a few cash out refis, some purchases. We're seeing a little bit of down payment assistance programs outside of LA, really.
Yeah.
But it's either, you know, yeah, take up a hobby or you're going to be twiddling your thumbs. It's pretty quiet.
All right. So to your would-be clients then, the Federal Reserve has made it pretty clear that interest rates are going to be higher for longer is the phrase in monetary policy circles. That means, you know, like a year or more-ish of this. What do you suppose happens to real estate?
Well, I mean, you know, Jerome Powell's made it very clear. He doesn't want inflation to go back up. So they're going to keep rates high until they feel like the economy's stabilized. Is it going to take a year? I hope not. I would say at least, I don't know, 7-8 months. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to have to ride it out. You can look at other kind of programs, like I said, down payment assistance. Sellers are doing, I'm seeing seller carrybacks. They're holding the loans.
What are seller carrybacks? What does that mean?
So the sellers, a seller of a house is telling a potential buyer, I'll hold the loan, you know, at a lower rate than you get at a bank.
Okay, yeah.
So we're seeing a little bit of that as well, but it is making an impact. We're seeing it, of course, nationally and in LA too, even in the city of LA where, you know, we have our own kind of microeconomy.
Right, right. Are you surprised, generally speaking, across the country, that prices have not fallen farther, if at all, given how high rates are?
Not really, because everyone's sitting on such low interest rates from, you know, the refinances that happened during COVID. So you have no incentive. You know, you've got a rate of 3%. You're going to be reluctant to give up that rate. You're not going to want to go anywhere unless you have to.
What are you looking for? What are going to be your indicators that something has started to unfreeze?
You know, just, well, I think if we start to see any difference in inventory, really, which, to be honest, I'm not sure that inventory is going to, you know, open up too much. But once we start to see, you know, more inventory, we know that housing prices will come down and there'll be more movement. You know, of course, rates coming down, but I don't think that's going to happen for at least 7-8 months, like I said.
Do you even like going to the office anymore?
I do. I actually do. I'm here most of the time. I mean, I certainly come in later and I leave earlier, but anything that's priced well is going to sell, but it is quiet. Like I said, I probably should have taken up golf a few months ago.
Vivian Geller, she's at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles. Vivian, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, so look, here's what happened. Demand for those safe haven assets, U.S. Treasury bonds in particular, that fell off a little bit, which sent yields, that is to say interest rates, higher. And stocks seemed attractive again, as there has been so far, as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said again the other day, no wider global economic fallout from the Middle East. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Title 11 of the United States Code, the U.S. Code is the collection of the permanent laws of the United States. Title 11 is the Bankruptcy Code, and Chapter 11 of Title 11 is titled simply Reorganization. And it's that bucket into which Rite Aid deposited itself last night. The third largest pharmacy chain in this economy had been in trouble for a while, rising debt, as well as legal fees and settlements related to the opioid epidemic. It'll keep on operating, Rite Aid will, while it restructures and closes some stores. But Rite Aid aside, this has been a tough year for retail pharmacies in general. Staff walkouts at CVS and Walgreens, more products locked up behind plastic barriers in stores, which have fewer hours to begin with. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on what's been going on with the neighborhood pharmacy.
The pharmacy business has seen lots of change in the last few decades. Donald Klepser is Senior Associate Dean at the University of Nebraska's College of Pharmacy and has seen those changes firsthand.
My parents were independent pharmacy owners as I grew up, and there are fewer of them. Now, my parents, they actually sold to Rite Aid, as luck would have it, back in 2007.
Now he prepares his students for an industry that's less entrepreneurial and more stressful than the one from his childhood. Staffing shortages have hit all the major chains, and it's getting harder and harder for individual stores to turn a profit, says George Hill, the senior healthcare technology and services analyst at Deutsche Bank.
You've got reimbursement that's going down. As a company with a lot of debt is watching interest rates go up, it just doesn't make for an attractive backdrop for a company like Rite Aid.
Hill points out that brick-and-mortar retail pharmacies are competing with supermarkets and wholesale clubs that don't really need to make money off the prescriptions. Plus, there are new online pharmacies with lower overhead and staffing costs.
If you were charting how much money pharmacies make per prescription, it would be a pretty steep chart down and to the right, and has been for well over a decade.
All of this is contributing to more consolidation in the industry, which worries Curtis Haas, chief pharmacy officer at the University of Rochester Medical Center in New York.
Rite Aid, at least in our region, has been one of the pharmacy chains that tended to maintain a presence in underserved communities.
Now, Rite Aid hasn't announced yet which of its stores will be closing, but Haas says,
I think you'll see contraction in the traditional, you know, every corner having a pharmacy kind of things that we've gotten used to something that's going to look quite a bit different.
Which, he says, could also make things more difficult for some communities to get access to their medicines. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Retail sales for September come out tomorrow. Closely watched would be a good way to describe how they'll be greeted, all the more so because consumers have been getting a little cranky lately. So while we wait, we have called Annie Lang Hartman. She's one of our small business regulars. She runs the stationery and boutique shop Wild Letty up in Leelanau County, Michigan.
We're coming off of a very, very busy summer. We're kind of settling into fall, which is a little bit quieter for us. It's kind of riding that wave right now and spending some downtime, like regrouping, getting inventory back to where we want it to be for the holidays. And even though it's quieting down, there's still plenty to do. I'm spending pretty much all of my times in the store talking to customers all day, and then either before or after, I'm in our office packing orders, and I would say at least 75% of the people coming through the door in the summer are tourists. And this time of year, we are having a lot more conversations with locals. That's the name of the game in Leelanau County. We're a tourist area. We work with a lot of different vendors now, and we've been seeing price increases from different brands that we work with, but it's never anything that's super significant that keeps us from wanting to buy and sell the products that we've been stocking. I think I will eventually raise prices. We're a team of 7 or 8 and during the height of our season. So our payroll is our biggest cost most of the time. And being able to give my employees raises and bonuses and hopefully benefits down the line, like I will have to raise the cost of some of my products to cover that. I don't feel any anxiety as far as raising prices because it's not going to be like, oh, we need to double the retail price of anything. It's going to be small changes. Our biggest sellers are still stationery, so maybe 25 cents a card is not going to make a lot of people be like, no, we can't buy from them anymore, hopefully. Hopefully. We'll see. I just really hope that we have a very healthy holiday season. And I hope for a better work-life balance next year to, you know, not be working 7 days a week, 12 plus hours a day. That next year we carry over a lot of our great team members. Hopefully we can hire a few more and just give everyone responsibilities and tasks and roles. And I'm not running around like a crazy person.
Annie Lang Hartman, Wild Letty, Northern Michigan. Podcast, we have one. Subscribe, follow your favorite platform. Coming up,
you'll see car bodies, you'll see refrigerators, you'll see water heaters.
Turns out it's a story about global trade. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 314 points today, 0.9%, closed at 33,984. The NASDAQ gained 160 points, that's about 1.2%. 13,567. The S&P 500 climbed 45 points. Tad more than 1% there, 43 and 73. Kimberly Adams was telling us a minute ago about Rite Aid's financial problems and its plan to file for bankruptcy to deal with billions in debt from opioid lawsuits and other challenges. Trading in that company stock was halted today, as happens. Elsewhere, though, in retail pharmacy, Walgreens slid 2%, CVS down less than a tenth percent today. Bond prices were down as well. I mentioned that. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.70%. Prices go down, yields go up. That's the way the bond market works. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So as the days get shorter and eventually colder, a little good news heading into winter. Most American households are probably going to spend less on heating bills this year than last. That's according to the latest prediction from the Energy Information Administration, its winter fuels outlook. It's partly because prices are down, sure. Also partly because it's looking like it should be a milder winter for much of the country. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
If you use natural gas to heat your home, you should be in luck this winter. Juan Alvarado at the American Gas Association says production has increased, storage levels are higher, and the market is less volatile than it was a year ago. And because of that,
prices have definitely stabilized this year. They're much lower than they were last year.
Which is good news for the roughly half of U.S. households that use natural gas for heat. As for everyone else,
with electricity and propane, those households will see similar bills to last year, and with heating oil, bills will likely be a bit higher than last year.
Joe DeCarlis is administrator of the Energy Information Administration. He says energy prices are one factor in EIA's forecast. The other is weather. And right now, it's looking like it'll be a milder winter for parts of the country, which should also help keep heating bills lower. Though, of course, there's no way to know for sure.
The biggest variable is the winter temperature. If we have a much colder winter, that can drive expenditures significantly higher.
Still, overall, Mark Wolf at the National Energy Assistance Directors Association says we're in a better place heading into this winter heating season than we have been in a few years.
It's been pretty grim. You know, first we had the pandemic, prices came down, and then prices went up when the economy started to recover. We had the war in the Ukraine where Russia cut off supplies of natural gas to Western Europe, and then Western Europe was looking for everywhere possible they could get natural gas, so that pushed up prices.
But even if everything stays as stable as it looks now, Wolf says heating bills are still high. And he's worried about having enough money for families who are struggling to pay their bills and need help from the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP.
Last year, Congress provided us with an extra $2 billion for a total of $6 billion. This year, Congress has not moved on the extra request.
And if LIHEAP doesn't get that extra $2 billion again this year, he says they'll have to cut about 1 million families from the program. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
There are, give or take, 500 publicly traded companies that are going to be reporting earnings this week across virtually all sectors of this economy. The electric vehicle industry and analysts who covered are going to be keeping a close eye out on Wednesday when Tesla reports. In particular, they're going to be watching for the effects of Tesla's price cuts over the past year, which have put other EV makers in a tough spot as they look to compete with the market leader for EV buyers' attention. Marketplace's Henry Epp has that one.
For about a year, Tesla's sales strategy has basically boiled down to this: sell more cars for less money. Thanks to years of high profit margins, the company could afford it, says Seth Weintraub, publisher of the EV news site Electrek.
They're really just blowing out their market share, not letting others kind of compete in their space.
Though others are trying, including Ford, GM, Toyota, and lots of other traditional automakers. And all of those competitors have cut into Tesla's piece of the EV pie in the U.S., says Dan Ives, managing director at Wedbush Securities.
We see over 100 automakers going after electric vehicles. They'll lose some market share, but they continue to be the clear leader in the EV market.
According to a report by Cox Automotive last week, Tesla's share of the EV market in the U.S. fell to 50% in the third quarter. That's its lowest level on record, but the company still has a lot of weight to throw around. When it cut prices, it put other companies into a bind, says Seth Goldstein, an equity strategist at Morningstar.
It means that other automakers have to figure out a way to lower their costs while also cutting prices to spur demand.
A tall order for traditional car makers whose EVs, unlike Tesla's, are not yet profitable. The company has also figured out ways to lock in revenue streams from its customers well after their initial purchase, Goldstein says.
From things like charging, from things like the full self-driving subscription software, and in the growing number of U.S. states, Tesla's also offering insurance.
But it's also offering Elon Musk. And Seth Weintraub with Electrek says that could turn out to be a big problem.
Those folks that I know on the left that would possibly be Tesla owners have told me quite a bit that they don't want to buy a Tesla because of Elon.
But he says if a Tesla is $10,000 cheaper than the competition, principal might have to ride in the back seat. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
The big United Nations Climate Change Conference is going to get going in Dubai in about a month and a half. The UN says the two-week meeting, you'll hear it referred to as COP28 for the 28th Conference of the Parties, if you're curious. The UN says it's going to be an opportunity for participants to reboot their climate change work, specifically cutting carbon emissions in half by 2030. There will be a couple of familiar themes: investments in renewable energy and cleaner infrastructure, more private investment in climate solutions, and also maybe one unfamiliar theme: trade policy and the role that it can play in lowering emissions. Marketplace's Justin Ho has been looking into how tariffs can help reduce climate change.
For decades, the conventional wisdom and trade theory has been that tariffs have a downside. They increase prices for everybody.
Any increase in U.S. producers' input prices is going to filter down to somebody.
Katie Russ is an economics professor at UC Davis.
Whether it's reduced profits for U.S. companies, which may affect employment and investment, or higher prices directly to the consumer.
The newer thinking is that higher prices for certain imports might actually be good for the environment. One example is the steel industry. I'm at a scrapyard called Lee's Iron and Metal near San Diego. Two excavators are sorting through huge mounds of metal. George Vasquez is the yard supervisor.
You'll see car bodies, you'll see refrigerators, you'll see water heaters.
One of the excavators grabs a pickup truck and lifts it into a machine that crushes it into a cube. Lee's Iron and Metal buys this scrap from people who drop off old junk: construction companies, government agencies. And once owner Steve Glukoff's crew sorts the metal and compresses it, his company sells it.
A little bit to Taiwan, a little bit to Vietnam. We also sell into Mexico. And then, of course, there is the forever changing U.S. market.
Glukhof sells a lot of metal directly to U.S. steel mills. They've been melting down recycled metal since the 70s, using machines called electric arc furnaces. More than 70% of steel in the U.S. is now made this way, according to the Steel Manufacturers Association. And it's a very different process than the old-fashioned method, mining raw materials and burning coal. Alan Collard Wexler, a professor at Duke, says the industry had good reasons to switch to the electric method.
It both didn't have to use coal and also just used a lot less, essentially, heat to produce new steel.
As a result, steel production in the U.S. is a lot cleaner than it was up until the 70s. But other big steel-producing countries, including India and China, are still burning coal to make steel from scratch because they don't have enough scrap metal lying around.
Mainly because to have scrap steel lying around, you would have needed to produce steel for the last 100 years, and China just hasn't had the kind of same industrial expansion in the 1890s and 1900s that the U.S. had in the steel sector.
For decades, that dirty steel wasn't subject to much in the way of tariffs, while goods produced with smaller carbon footprints, including vehicles, had higher tariffs, says Joe Shapiro, a professor at UC Berkeley.
You could think of that as a subsidy to greenhouse gas emissions, because we're charging lower tariffs on imported goods that are emitting more greenhouse gases.
Shapiro looked into what would happen if every country simply set a single tariff for everything. He found that demand for dirtier goods would fall, and that would make a big dent in global CO2 emissions.
It would have similar impact on global greenhouse gas emissions as if the U.S. put a substantial limit on greenhouse gas emissions from energy-intensive industries.
The Trump administration raised tariffs on imported steel back in 2018. A report from the International Trade Commission found that those tariffs increased steel production in the U.S. by 2%, even though American steel is more expensive than Chinese steel because of higher labor and environmental compliance costs. Katie Russ at UC Davis says it's still too early to tell whether trade theory is starting to factor in the potential environmental benefits of higher tariffs.
I haven't heard it sinking meaningfully into policy debate at this point, which is shocking to me.
Even if reduced global emissions are an unintended consequence of tariffs on imported steel, Russ says it's a welcome one. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick update on the intersection of artificial intelligence and the labor force. LinkedIn, which is owned by Microsoft, in case you'd forgotten, announced layoffs today, about 600 people, around 3% of its global workforce. Saw this on Axios today, that the company's working on a whole raft of new artificial intelligence products, including AI-assisted job candidate discovery for recruiters, also AI-powered coaching for premium subscribers. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context, getting us full circle to where we started: real estate, high mortgage rates, and home sales. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal, some data from Redfin that shows existing home sales this year are going to drop to their lowest level since 2008. And we all remember what was going on in 2008, right? Right? Right. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. If you don't remember what was happening in 2008, email me. I'll tell you. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.